Go ahead. See?
Stay tuned for the Organic Farm Stand coming right up.
Corn in the fields, listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come. I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me. And I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down that pay. Looks like this time I'm gonna get to stay. I'm a union man now all the way. From the magnolia trees in the meadow, King harvest is surely come. A dry summer didn't come fall.
All right, welcome to the Organic Farm Stand, which comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month from 12 to 1. My name is Richard Hill, all by myself here in the studio today. Where's Laura? Laura, if you're out there, if you can hear us, please come home, Laura. Laura, where are you? I know you're wandering in the wilderness somewhere. Oh, forget it. I'm just trying to get my engine revved up here because we got a great show, fantastic show, as usual. But no, this one is really special. We got all kinds of things happening. First of all, I want to bring Steve Munno on the line. Steve, are you with us?
Yes, great to be here.
Yeah, fantastic to have you. Steve is the manager. Actually, what is the official title? Because it changed recently from farm manager to, is it still farm manager?
I am the executive director, and I'll be happy to share news about a new farm manager here as well.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. Well, executive director of Massaro Farm, which is in Woodbridge, on Ford Road. I'm starting to get that memorized because I had a really hard time, my GPS, finding it. I don't know why. My GPS just failed on me one time when I was trying to get there. But it's, I think, 41 Ford Road in Woodbridge?
That's right. Yeah, we're right on the town line with Ansonia, so sometimes the GPS gets confused because across the street is Ansonia, and we're on the Woodbridge side, so the numbers can throw it off a little bit.
All right. Well, we'll try to get that GPS back in function mode. And did I mention my name is Richard Hall? I can't remember because nobody's here to remind me. But anyway, we have a special show today. First of all, we're going to be hearing from Dana Jackson, who is the communications director at CT NOFA. That's the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And Dana's going to bring us up to date on the winter conference, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks. And that's a special event, which we need to know about. And if you need details, which we don't cover today, you can just go to the CT NOFA website. That's ctnofa.org. And look at that website. It's really pretty spiffy now. They did a great job with the recent reconstruction or something. And so you'll find all the information you need and tons of other information, too, which is very cool. Because you can find about all the organic farms in the area. You can find out about organic land care, all kinds of stuff like that, which is really, you know, right up your alley. So Dana will be here. Actually, Dana is here. Dana, are you with us?
I sure am. Good morning.
Yeah, fantastic. This is great. We're really happy that you could bring us direct information on the CT NOFA Winter Conference. But one second before we go there, I want to mention that we also have with us Vincent Kay, who's going to be giving us the honeybee update coming up at about 12:20. And then our special guest today is Esther Armand, who is an African-American woman who lives in New Haven, but who grew up on a farm in the can I say this, please help me? Mississippi Delta. She grew up there from birth until she finished high school. And so she has a lot to say and a lot to tell us about what it was like to be growing up in a farming community back in the 50s and 60s on the Delta, which is really pretty unusual for us up here. We don't know much about that. So we're going to find about that with Esther starting at 12:30 today. So glad she could join us. So we have, as you can see, a very full menu. So why don't we get right to it with Dana, followed by the Small Farms Report with Steve. Dana, what do you got for us?
Hey, well, good morning again. Thanks for having me on this morning, guys.
Pleasure.
So let me tell you guys a little bit about this year's CT NOFA Winter Conference. This is our 42nd annual Winter Conference, so we've been doing this for quite a while now. And we're excited this year to be hosting it in partnership with Eastern Connecticut State University over in Willimantic. This is the first time, as far as I know, that we've had the opportunity to host the conference in the eastern portion of the state. So we're excited to bring it over to that side. And it is coming your way on Saturday, March 23rd. That's going to be our full in-person day at Eastern Connecticut. And we'll also be having 2 days of virtual workshops that precede that on the 20th and the 21st. We're doing it that way because, frankly, we have a ton of workshops. We've got 40 workshops scheduled that cover a number of different interest tracks, everything from organic land care to home gardening and homesteading, to beginning farmer, just to name a few. So most of those will be taking place in person, but like I said, we do have 2 days full of virtual workshops as well that people can attend on their computer or on their phone or what have you. But the big day is the 23rd on Saturday, where we will be, in addition to the full roster of workshops, we'll be providing lunch. We'll be having the presentation of the Bill Ducine Organic Living on the Earth Award. And for those who don't know, Bill Ducine was CT NOFA's founder. He passed away a number of years ago, and this award was created to honor his dedication to organic and sustainable living. I can't tell you who, not authorized yet to tell you who the winner is, but I can tell you that she is a Connecticut farmer. And she's a really great speaker, so I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say when she's presented with the award. And speaking of speakers, our keynote address is going to be provided by Maya Van Rossum. Now, Maya is the founder of a national organization called Green Amendments for the Generations. And what that is an organization dedicated to advancing legislation in all 50 states to provide what they call a green amendment, which is essentially an enshrinement of environmental rights for the citizens of the state. Now, there's a couple of states that have already gone and gotten this passed, but what it is intended to provide is a legal platform for citizens to advocate for environmental rights. It includes the freedom to have clean water, clean air, to have an environment free of poisons, pesticides, that kind of thing. So it's a really important movement, and Maya is going to have a lot to say about it, not only what the implications of it are, but also how people can get involved in the movement and help to get legislation passed in their state and notably here in Connecticut. We'll also have our soil health table open where we'll be discussing upcoming microscopy courses for farmers or home gardeners who are interested in learning more about the microscopic health level of the soil that they're growing in and how they might be able to amend it or improve it to better suit what they want to grow there. There will also be an after-hour social event, which is hosted by our good friends over at the New Connecticut Farmers Alliance. And we'll have more information about that in the next week or so. And we're also offering a selection of our workshops in Spanish translation for those who would prefer to hear it in Spanish or those who need to hear it in Spanish because they don't speak English. And we'll have more information about that as well in the next week or so. So anybody who's interested can register on our website, which, Richard, as you mentioned, is ctnofa.org. That's ctnofa.org. You'll find links to the Winter Conference right there on the homepage. You can peruse all of the workshops we're going to be offering, take a look at our speakers, and, of course, register. And I would like to say that last year the conference sold out, and we were not able to provide tickets at the door, which is something that in the past we had been able to do. And we suspect that we're going to sell out again this year. So if you'd like to attend, we highly encourage you to get your tickets soon before it's sold out, because we can't wait to see everybody there on the 23rd.
And Dana, I know in the past there have been some pretty scrumptious meals that have been served, these potlucks and huge selections of natural food and stuff like that. Can you tell us about that at the conference?
Sure, yeah. So way back in the day, the conference started actually as a potluck-type event, and it has grown to the point where that just really is not feasible for us anymore. We're expecting 400 attendees, and a 400-person potluck, while fun, would probably be a little chaotic. So thankfully, we're going to partner with Eastern Connecticut, and their catering service is going to be bringing in a full buffet for lunch, which will include both vegetarian and vegan options, and gluten-free as well. So that's going to be how we're conducting lunch this year.
And I believe that's included in the price of your registration?
Yes, registration includes lunch, and it also includes your digital pass to the virtual workshops that are happening on the 20th and the 21st. So it's a fully inclusive ticket. You buy it once, and you're invited to attend everything that we have to offer.
What a great update. That's Dana Jackson, the communications director at CTNOFA. And boy, I'm going to put that on my calendar and get registered for that. It sounds great. Thank you so much, Dana.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
All right. We're going to move on now to Steve Munno with the Small Farms Report from Massaro Farms in Woodbridge. Steve, this is a very strange day. We've had days of rain, but today, you know, it's like a gray day, but it has a tropical feel to it. It's almost balmy. What's it like out there in Woodbridge?
It's windy and muddy. So it is, you know, happily not as cold as it had been previously, but you might even hear the wind blowing through, you know, through the microphone in the background, because it's been pretty gusty throughout the day, which sometimes kind of rattles the house here. And it's wet. You know, we still have this issue of wetness throughout the farm. And so we would be expecting mud season at this time. You know, it's been a much muddier winter than usual. And so that's revealing itself a bit more now, given the rain that we've just had. You know, I don't know where we're in this storm at the moment, but we were expecting a couple of inches of rain between yesterday and today. And so hopefully some sunshine will come and help dry us out, as, you know, we hope to be getting into the ground as soon as we are able. And too much moisture makes it difficult for us to do that.
And what's going – how does this kind of early mud season and muddier mud season, how does that affect your plans for growing? Does it move your schedule at all? Or, I mean, I know you grow in the high towers all winter, the greens and other vegetables growing all winter. But in terms of planning for the planting that you'll be doing, you know, a couple of months from now.
Yeah, it can, but this muddiness can shift our schedule a little bit, but we have, as you alluded to, you built the high tunnels and used them in a way, you know, not only to grow all year round, but also to allow us to have a reliable early season planting. So when we started, you know, we're now entering our 15th year and I didn't have any tunnels. You know, we could only do what the conditions allowed us to outside. And if it were too wet, then, you know, we can't get into the soil. Because what happens if you're using your equipment in the field when it's too wet, you end up compacting the soil and you end up sort of, you know, destroying that sort of soil structure by removing the pathways for air and roots and oxygen, you know, to travel through the soil. So we don't want to do that. And every soil is different here at Massaro. We are a bit rocky. You know, we're at the top of a hill. We don't have super well draining soil. So other farms might not have this issue. If you've got really sandy soil and you're draining and actually retaining water can be an issue, and retaining nutrients can be an issue. That's not as much of an issue here for us. In the spring for us, we sort of root for the drier conditions so that we can get into the ground sooner because the wetness really holds here, and we'll see some puddling, you know, in the spring almost always. So, but the high tunnels have allowed us to have a reliable space to plant early in the season. So as we have built them, we've been able to transition more of our plan for early season planting into those tunnels. So, you know, the first crop of lettuce or turnips or collards or kale or cabbage, you know, that might have gone into the field for us 10 years ago, now we're planting them in the tunnel regardless. Now, we'll take advantage of a dry season if we can get into the field. But, you know, last year before it got so wet, we actually were sort of dry in the spring. And I did a few plantings that were a little risky. And, you know, we had a lot of rain come after that and flood out this field. So we lost that planting, those early plantings that we had tried to get. So, you know, we learned those lessons over and over, and we, you know, try to build in some flexibility to our crop plan so that, you know, maybe that early planting would have worked out if we didn't get the rain that we did last April, you know, and turned out it didn't, and that's okay. We have to roll with what happens, you know, what the weather and the climate is bringing to us. But happily, the tunnels give us some flexibility for some reliable planting early in the season here.
Can you talk a little about crop rotation in your operation there? How much of that is part of your planning?
Yeah, crop rotation is key. You know, understanding that, you know, different crops have different nutrient needs. You know, and oftentimes I like to think about things that are in the ground for a long time and producing a lot as being heavy feeders. So your tomatoes, your eggplants, your peppers are in the ground for a long time and sort of constantly producing fruit for you. You know, being a heavy feeder needs a lot of nutrients, and something that's smaller and quicker and not in the ground as long, like a radish or a head of lettuce or, you know, a bunch of scallions. You know, they have nutrient needs, but not at the same level that those heavier feeders are. So think about the nutrient needs of the plants and rotating them around, and also the families. So, you know, these things that are related to each other, moving them around so they don't have a buildup of a pest or a disease in that area, so that you bring them to a new spot each year. And it is something we plan on, but then we also have to be mindful of our fields. You know, they vary because we're on a little bit of a slope. We actually have three soil types moving through our farm, and farm areas that get a little better sun, you know, some that get sun right away in the morning, some that have a little steeper slope, and so they drain easier. And so, you know, that area of the farm is a little more reliable early in the season than other areas of the farm. So, you know, we have to match, you know, both, or we have to consider both our rotation needs with those, you know, the feeding of the crops and the families of the crops, with also the sort of weather and climate and soil conditions. So when it's going to get sun and when it's going to drain. And so we have to factor all those things in. It's not as simple as just mapping a rotation and moving them around, because our fields, you know, respond to things differently. You know, we have areas that late in the season don't get as much sun because of, you know, the angle of the sun in the sky. And so those are just things that we need to consider here at our particular, you know, in our particular field in our farm. So there's a lot that plays into it. And then, you know, as things change, as a planting maybe is successful or isn't successful, we have to be able to make changes on the fly as well. So we build some of those into our plan, and then we have to, you know, be flexible throughout the season.
And I want to turn to the topic of eggs, because I was at the farm, I guess a week ago, 10 days ago, and I got some of your farm fresh eggs. And You seem to have a lot of them. I was surprised that you had such a good supply, because I'll tell you, you know, getting fresh eggs from organic farms is pretty tough in different spots that I've tried to get them. So I was happy to find that you had a good supply of them. What constitutes a really fresh egg? Like, how long can an egg be sort of, after hatching, can sit in a cool space, like a refrigerated area, and still be considered fresh?
Well, that's a good question. We all of our eggs are typically consumed within just a few weeks. I sort of have 6 weeks as the absolute limit of when we would continue to offer them, or, you know, make sure we maybe use them for something else at that stage, or for ourselves for hard boiling or something. But our eggs don't last long for the most part, especially during the height of the season from, you know, June through November. At that time of year, you know, the eggs are being eaten within the week, really, because we have our CSA and farm stand and farmers market that are consuming, you know, essentially the same amount that's being produced on a weekly basis. Over the winter, we do our farm stand and market every other week. And so, you know, without having pickups, you know, twice a week like we do during the rest of the year, you know, we have a little bit of buildup. And, you know, every other week we're sort of clearing out the last 2 weeks or so of the egg laying. So we've had a little, you know, over the winter, it gives us a little bit of buildup. And then we, you know, have plenty available for those farm stand days and market days. And then over the next couple of weeks, we build up that supply again. So, you know, I'd say, you know, it's really nice to have a fresh egg, you know, within a week and even 2 weeks. And after that is when you can notice if you like to hard boil eggs for anything. Fresh eggs aren't good for that, because they don't peel well. So the longer they set, kind of the better. So, you know, actually, if you want a hard boiled egg for anything, or you're making deviled eggs for something, or, you know, you actually want a slightly older egg because that shell has set a little bit better and is easier to peel later on. So, you know, different eggs have different purposes. But yeah, most of ours are going to be used within 1 to 2 weeks.
Yeah.
For most of the year.
Do you have an opinion on the issue of refrigeration for eggs? I think there's some debate about whether it's necessary to keep eggs in the refrigerator.
Yeah, well, I think the United States is a little bit unique in refrigerating eggs. I think as you know, if you get a chance to travel abroad, you'll find eggs are commonly unrefrigerated through much of the world. But once you do refrigerate them, you must keep them refrigerated. So, you know, in terms of food safety. And so that's the common place here in the States for them to be refrigerated, and we're required to refrigerate them. So once we collect eggs and once we wash them, they go into cold storage and they stay, you know, in a cold refrigerator throughout the rest of their use. But, you know, for my own use, I'm happy to collect some eggs, bring them in the house and leave them unrefrigerated, you know, as long as they've never been refrigerated.
Got it.
So I think you'll find that's common, but, you know, for the U.S. And our food regulations, you know, we've got to keep them. We got to keep them in cold storage.
Very good. And just a note here, before I bring Vincent on, Vincent Kay, the beekeeper who was going to give us the honeybee update. I spoke to some growers, fruit shrub growers, this past week to ask about when is the proper time to prune your fruit shrubs and how to do it. And since I have raspberry and blueberry bushes in my backyard, I asked about those, and I was surprised to hear that for raspberries, this particular guy suggested cutting the canes down to the ground. You don't just clip off the upper area of the cane. He suggested going all the way down to the base, which really surprised me. As for blueberries, he said there really isn't much trimming you need to do. You really don't need to cut back much there, unless it's a dead branch which is growing out from somewhere, you know, on the perimeter or inside, you know, the clump. You want to cut that out, because that's just going to divert energy away from the actual live and growing branches. So those were two tips that I picked up this week about pruning your fruit shrubs.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I would just add, if you've got raspberries, you can actually use a mower. You know, that's a common thing to do. So if you've got a walk behind or a riding mower, you can mow those down to the ground, and the new canes will emerge from the ground in the spring. So you can mow it and let it come back. And for the blueberries, yes, you want to cut those. Anything that's broken, you know, you want to, just clean up. Allow some more light. You can do some thinning too to allow some light in there, and you can manage it, but it doesn't tend to need as much pruning. But raspberries, can use a mowing in the fall. You know, sort of as soon as you're done with their crop, you can kind of mow those down. And depends. There are flora canes and primacanes, so there's slightly different strategies. But it's okay to mow them down and let them come back once they're established.
And this is not too late to do this, by the way, according to the fellow I spoke with.
Often it would happen in the fall, but I think it's not too late to do that. We're not yet into spring growth for things. And so similarly, if you're doing, other fruit trees, you do the pruning, the sort of winter pruning. There is summer pruning as well, which is sort of a different thing or it has a different purpose. But for your fruit trees, you want to do it when it's dormant. So when it's cold and when it's dry. You never want to prune when it's wet because you don't want to, open up a vector for disease. You get that moisture in there and then you can have some disease buildup. So if it's, cold and dry, over the winter months are good times to think about pruning.
Very good.
But you still got some time now before we get to, a few more weeks here. A good time to do it. I don't like to do it when it's bitter cold, so if you find a decent day in the winter when it's, sunny and dry and then do some pruning.
Very good. All right. Well, let's bring Vincent Kay into the conversation. Vincent, the proprietor of Swords into Plowshares Honey. Vincent, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Great, yeah. Good. Thank you. We are. We just came from one bee yard in Hamden over the mountain, West Rock State Park. We've got a beautiful bee yard over here on the northwest corner of West Rock State Park. And John is working as I'm talking. He's checking hives for food. We've been pretty religious about sticking with the feeding. It's been a mild winter, so we were able to make sure that the bees had plenty of food. And that changed from dry pastry fondant, which we fed them when it was really cold, to now liquid syrup, which is just more liquid than nectar, but it's getting close to the same viscosity, so the bees don't really know the difference. And it's 54 degrees out right now where we are, and we're sort of on the edge of a hemlock stand, which I'm always a little... Hemlocks are pretty sturdy. we made sure we parked the truck a little bit away from major trees because it's very windy out. And so we're here. Electric fence is working well. And the bees are actually flying. Every hive in this bee yard is flying. I wouldn't say they're out there in huge quantities, but they're what we call trickle fly. And they basically, it's a steady stream of bees that are going out to gather water and some pollen. The chickweed is blooming now against the ground. Pussy willows in warm spots are producing lots of pollen. You'll see the maple syrup people. They've got their trees tapped and ready to go and are actually gathering syrup, or I should say sap, for making into syrup. And so things are starting to move. You'll see on south-facing slopes, maple trees are starting to redden, and those buds provide the bees with an early source of nectar and pollen. And, in general, if there's a way that beekeepers can really check their hives now, it's an extremely important time because I've mentioned before on your show, Richard, that in the spring, but in general, all year long, once they start laying eggs, once that queen is starting to gear up and laying a pattern of eggs that the bees have to sit on, just like birds, to keep warm, the inside of that nest goes to 95 degrees. And that heat production keeps the eggs warm and allows them to mature into larvae and pupate into young bees and hatch out in, 20, 24, 25 days. But the amount of food that the bees go through in order to create that heat is a lot. It's astronomical, actually. So you have to make sure, we don't like feeding bees, but you have to make sure that the bees have enough food, and extremely important. You know, people say, well, why did my hive die? And, you know, I'll go over and I'll see that there's no food in the hive. And it's such a preventable thing that people who beekeepers can actually intercede and help a hive get through the dearth and also the early spring lack of nectar. And these hives will then become very productive and very healthy during the regular season. So it's something that, you know, beekeepers have to learn to do, which is check to see how much food is in a hive. John is going now, he's tipping each hive to see the weight. And if he has a doubt, he actually bends over and actually lifts the hive. And you can get an idea from that how much food is left in the hive, the sort of net weight of food versus the bees and the wood and everything that comprises the actual hive itself. So that's what we're doing. And we have a lot of bees this year. So if people are not so fortunate, we have a pretty good price on nucleus colonies. We do sell bees to other beekeepers. And so they should be in touch. We do sell bees. They're called nukes for short. Nucleus colonies consist of a laying queen and five frames of bees, of drawn comb with bees and food. And it's a way to get back in the business or into the hobby of keeping bees. That's the industry standard. So we do sell bees, as well as honey, of course, and pollination services for orchards and later crops, things like raspberries and blueberries, actually.
What kind of space would be recommended if somebody was interested in getting a hive and starting, you know, just a very low profile
That's a great question.
Thing.
And it's the most probably important question. I have, even in the city, and there's a number of urban beekeepers that have done very well, because there's a lot of shrubs and trees in the cities that produce a wonderful honey. And anyhow, we look for a spot in the yard, which is a sunny spot, a little bit elevated, so that in the cooler weather, when it's when you get a frost, you'll notice that the frost settles in certain parts of the yard, which usually are lower, a little more shaded. Those are the spots you do not want to put the hive. So you want to have it elevated, well drained. You don't want to have them in water, but you want them near water. A fresh source of water is very important. You don't want them, going to the local car wash to get sudsy water to bring back. And that is a problem. Sometimes, that's one of the first things we look for is a good source of clean water. They can also become annoyances to neighbors who have bird baths and leaky faucets. And sometimes in the summer, when it's really, really dry and hot, the bees will actually go in large numbers to these areas to try to get water, and they can become a nuisance that way. And people get kind of irritated and the whole thing starts to fall apart. So you want to try to prevent things and be a good steward of the land and of the hive. So it's a kind of husbandry, which I guess is the right word to use, you can certainly, give the bees a beneficial go at it. One of the other things in an area where there's people and livestock, even we like to get the bees, and sometimes we'll even put up a structure to push the bees up as they come out of the hives. Something like if you face the hives into a wall of heavy brush or something, where there's some shade, but the bees are not in shade, but when they come out, they see that barrier, and it forces them to go almost straight up into the canopy of the trees, which, you know, is really a great thing for people, because you can kind of stand right in front of the hives and watch the hive, and you're guaranteed you're not going to get hit with bees or stung. And it's one of the little things. Some people I know have created actually physical barriers in front of the hive in the city out of wood or plywood or, you know, any kind of, you know, a pallet with certain colors on it. We'll push the bees in upward and out of, you know, kind of bumping into your head or your hair and getting stuck. We have people not too far from Steve's farm who constantly, I don't know why they do this, but they constantly come by the trail where we have a beautiful bee yard and on horseback, and they sit on top of the horses and right in front of the bees. And I'm like, wow, you know, we wish you wouldn't do that. We like the fact that you're interested in the bees, but if that horse gets stung and throws you into the hive, or even worse, the hive and the electric fence, you know, we could have some issues here. So we try to educate people. But it's you know, with the right area, you can do a lot with bees, and they're a great education for kids and young people. They love watching nature, and this is a great source of learning about nature and the environment we live in. Because of course, you know, people always say, "Well, is the honey organic?" And I always say, "Well, yes, but we don't really live in an organic society." So I mean, the bees are gathering and gleaning bits and pieces from all over the place and bringing it back to the hive. So, you know, they're as organic as we are. So it's a good way to educate people to have better gardens, more organic gardens, and treat the land and water with respect. So anyhow, but yeah, that's a great question as to where to set up a hive. I don't know if that answers it. But
yeah, that gives us a good start. And Vincent, I want to thank you so much for the report today. Everything is a little bit jammed up here because we have so much activity on the show today. But we always love to hear from you, and we will hear from you again. The first show of which month would it be? April, right?
Yeah.
Hard to believe.
Yep.
All
okay,
right.
Well, thank you. Our goal now is not to get stuck because it is mud season. So we've got to put it in four-wheel drive and try to get out of here in one piece. So,
well, thank you.
Thank you, Richard. And good to chat.
Thank you for including us in your very busy day there. All right, Vincent, talk to you soon.
Oh, take care.
All right. And now we want to introduce our very special guest, Esther Armand, who grew up on a family farm in the very rich flatlands of the Mississippi Delta over 50 years ago. And she's one of seven siblings. She worked on the 100 acres that her parents farmed for 30 years. Esther's tenure on the farm extended through her high school years, after which she eventually migrated north and settled in New Haven. And in New Haven, Esther worked for years in the field of addiction prevention and recovery in the local government as a leader in the development of adult and youth services as a public policy analyst on environmental issues. So Esther is now retired and she lives in New Haven. She grows vegetables, herbs, flowers in the community garden at Edgerton Park. I call it Edgerton, much to the dismay of my partner, Leslie, who insists it's Edgerton. So I'll defer to you on this one, Esther. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. It's good to be here.
Yeah. What a wonderful serendipitous thing that we happened to meet at Wanda Babriski's house a couple of weeks ago and struck up a conversation. And I found out that you were, in fact, farming in the Mississippi Delta, which is a kind of a legendary concept, I think, to us here in New England. So tell us.
Well, you know, you give me an opportunity to talk about something that is pretty rare. I don't get a chance to talk about that experience that much up this way.
Well, go for it. Just start us anywhere you want to, because we have so many questions about it. But, I mean, just, well, tell us everything. What was your family farm like? What was the community like? How did you know, that community intersect or interact with other communities that were? I mean, your farming community, as I understand it, was pretty much primarily or entirely African American. Am I right about that?
Well, the community I grew up in was not too far from a town called Anguilla, Mississippi. And Anguilla is a very small town in the Mississippi Delta along Highway 61 between Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Greenville, Mississippi. And I lived about 7 miles outside of that small town in very rural farm area along the Sunflower River and the Mount Bayou area. And in that area was a small group of all African-American farmers that own their own land, which was unique. I didn't understand how unique, you know, until actually later on in life. But, you know, it was a community that was within it a bit buffered, you know, from the outside. And the farmers, our family, you know, everybody worked on the farm, and we grew pretty much everything. And the land, much of the land, I mean, our parents bought some in their lifetime, but some of the land was purchased by our great-grandparents who were actually children in slavery in the area of, well, in the states of Mississippi and Louisiana. And we had a total of, it was over 100 acres. I don't know exactly the number of acreage at this time. And it was a pretty much self-contained community, at least for children. There was some interaction with the outside community, but it wasn't that often or frequent for us. You know, we lived in an all African American community. We went to all African American schools. We went to, you know, church African American. Our social activities were African American. And when you would go into town or more of the urban area, you know, there was a little interaction for brief periods of time with Caucasians, pretty much. But other than that, growing up all through high school, because the schools didn't become integrated until after I had graduated from high school and college, actually. And two of my younger sisters chose to go to an integrated school in high school. But other than that, it was a very close-knit community. It was a very caring community. And we lived on the land. And my parents, we grew pretty much all of the food we ate. You know, we grew, beans, corn, lettuce, potatoes, that was both white and sweet potatoes, peanuts, all kind of melons, greens, and we would eat that and pick, and we would harvest, and then we would store it over the winter enough to feed the family. We had cows, we had horses, we had pigs, we had fruit trees, nut trees. It was a lot of open space. And hard work, though. Don't get me wrong. Everybody worked. Everybody had chores and worked on the farm. And pretty much, you know, I look back, it was a lot of hard work. But, you know, that farm experience was so rich, which I did not realize fully at the time. You know, I think that everybody should have some opportunities to go and live on the farm for a little while, because it teaches you so much in terms of connecting to the soil, connecting to the earth, connecting to what you eat, connecting to nature. And it gives you a lot of open space, you know, to be creative. And there were a lot of lessons that I carry with me to this day. I learned to eat, you know, right off the farm, fresh. And that taught me at an early age what real food tastes like. And none of my siblings, none of us were able to become really junk food, you know, people when we were adults, because we knew what real food tastes like. And, you know, I think that that was a, it's a very, I guess, a beneficial and enriching opportunity. You know, I mean, it has its drawbacks, but, you know, it had more positives than negatives. And, you know, learning to grow vegetables and learning to pick them after you plant the seed and you see it grows, it's such a rewarding experience, actually. And when I see, you know, youth today that think groceries come from the can in the grocery store, you know, it's a bit sad to me, you know, because I think that it's very important for us to learn and respect how our food gets to our table and to learn about all of the necessary steps and the people and the hard work and the soil, you know, and the respect for the soil, because all of our food comes pretty much comes from the soil, you know, in some way, connected to that in some way. Mm-hmm. So I really respect and appreciate, and it has given me some lifelong lessons that I carry to this day in terms of, you know, patience, just respect, learning to work as a team, and the roles that different parts play in that to make it a success or to make it productive or make it to get to the outcome that one X would like to have. We also grew items that we sold, or my family sold, like cotton. I think cotton was probably the largest crop that we grew on the farm. But we also grew soybeans, wheat, oat, hay. And we also sold a few cows and a few hogs, but we always saved for the family first. The family got the first takes, and then what was excess, we would take, or my father would take it to the market and sell. So everybody worked hard, but everybody, you know, got the nourishment from the farm, and it really gave us a solid foundation for whatever we went on to do in life.
Wow, Esther, what a story. I'm going to bring Steve in if he chooses to come back on the conversation. And, I mean, it sounds almost like some kind of paradisic place, Steve, with, I mean, every conceivable type of fruit, nut, livestock, vegetable. What's your reaction?
Yeah, well, let me say something about Steve before you go. I mean, it's really interesting because I am a CSA member at Massara's Farm.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with the farm because, you know, weekly in the summertime, I go there to pick up vegetables and eggs.
Yeah, that must be a lifeline for you up here, Esther, where it's not so easy to get the kind of fresh organic stuff that you probably were producing.
But you know, I have a deep appreciation for local grown food because it is very different from what you get even from the grocery store that's fresh.
I get it. Totally. See, what's your reaction?
Yeah. Well, Esther, it's so great to hear your voice, and I'm so glad to have you here at Massaro. It's always lovely to see you here. And I was wondering, you know, as you were telling your story, I was wondering, you know, as you now are here in the New Haven area, just what your relationship with the land is like and how that transition has been for you. I mean, I think we do have, New Haven's an incredible city and we're doing, I think, an amazing job. People are doing amazing jobs of managing green spaces. But I wanted to hear from you just how your experience has been, you know, being in New Haven and your relationship with the land here.
Oh, well, thank you for that question. Actually, when I first moved here many, many years ago, I thought that this was not a place to live because it had too much concrete. And nobody should live on this much concrete, you know, around there. But over the year, and space is another thing, you know, I learned, you know, my perception of space was a lot bigger than most people that I've come in contact with up here. But over the years, you know, I have learned to appreciate, you know, the space that we do have, you know. And I have always had, I look for those little niches and those little areas to be. So right now I do have a community garden at the Edgerton Park. You know, it's in the Edgerton Park Conservancy Community Garden. Mm-hmm. And it is about, I'm going to say 15 by 30. And, you know, it gives me an opportunity to get out and be with other gardeners because I think there's a total of approximately, it's over 90 gardeners there and, you know, different sizes, but none are too big, but good size. And so we get out and we, you know, grow vegetables together. And it reminds me in some instances because one of the things we did growing up, we would always share, you know, the vegetables that one from one farm to the next, or one family to the next. And in the garden, when we grow different things, you get an opportunity to share with somebody next door that didn't grow it. And you learn about new things that you're not growing that others might be growing.
I just want to break in here. Excuse me, for 1 second to say that we are literally down to our last minute and a half. So,
oh, okay.
I mean, I want to.
You have questions.
Well, let me just say that we have obviously only just scratched the surface of your story. It is so rich, and I'm going to beg you to come back and, you know, go deeper and farther with this wonderful story because I want to hear about that. I thought sounded like paradise you were describing, you had the hard work. I'm not taking that away from
you. You do. And there are experiences we had and there were things we did that I look back and I'm saying, oh my God, we must have been crazy. But, you know, like we would play with snakes and, you know, I know that wasn't a good thing, but, you know, we're blessed. Nobody got bit. But I would love to come back.
All right. Well, you can hear that music coming up in the background, letting us know we only have 30 seconds to go. But so I want to thank everybody who participated today, but especially Esther Armand, who now gardens at Edgerton. I'm going to break my rule and say Edgerton. Edgerton Park in New Haven. Most people know it if they live in New Haven. It's right off Whitney Avenue. So thank you so much, Esther, for being with us. Come back. Steve.
Thank you so much.
Oh,
and
our pleasure.
I enjoyed talking about the experiences.
Yes, fantastic. Steve, talk to you soon.
All right. Steve, see you on the farm. Bye.
This is the Gaiagram. Environmental headlines from around a planet in crisis.
As ExxonMobil pursues litigation against activist shareholders who seek to push the biggest of all big oil behemoths to tougher environmental standards, CEO Darren Woods knows who to blame for the worsening climate crisis. It's not his company or its major competitors. In a recent interview with Fortune, Woods argued that the oil industry is not primarily to blame for climate breakdown. The world waited too long to develop green technologies, he said. Climate activists have accused Exxon and other big oil companies of stifling dissent. The industry is pulling out progressively more desperate measures to try to stop the activist shareholder movement because the industry sees that fossil fuels are losing. After a cargo ship sunk by Yemen Houthi rebels, warnings have been issued that the sinking of the Ruby Mar, which carried oil and 22,000 tons of fertilizer, could cause ecological damage to the Red Sea. At risk from the toxic substances on the ship are a bustling fishing industry, some of the world's largest coral reefs, and desalination plants supplying millions with drinking water. This is what climate change looks like. That's how University of Michigan climate scientist Jonathan Overpeck responded last week to reporting on the Smokehouse Creek fire in Texas, the biggest blaze ever recorded in Texas and the second largest in U.S. history. According to CBS News, the fire swiftly spread across 1.1 million acres in the Texas panhandle, where lampposts are now melted, power line posts are split in half, and homes and properties have been reduced to charred remains. As reported in Vox, the North Atlantic Ocean is on average warmer than any other time on record, running about 2 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the average temperature over the last 3 decades. Fueling this warming are our cars, power plants, and farms, which have blanketed Earth with heat-trapping greenhouse gases. Remarkably, 90% or so of that added warmth is absorbed by the oceans. Without them, experts believe we'd be in even more trouble. As many as hundreds of thousands of fall-run Chinook salmon died earlier last week due to suspected gas bubble disease. Gas bubble disease is non-infectious, and it's caused by environmental or physical trauma resulting from a change in pressure in spring or groundwater. Officials with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife believe up to 830,000 salmon fry succumbed to the disease as they migrated through the 16-foot-wide Iron Gate Dam Tunnel. The most populous city in North America is in the grips of a severe water crisis as lingering drought and years of low rainfall push the already strained system that supplies Mexico City with running water to its limits. More than 21 million residents across the Mexico City metropolitan area have endured weeks of water shortages, with local authorities imposing rations as reservoirs hit historic low levels. According to a new study reported in Electric, utility solar has dethroned coal as the cheapest power source in Asia. Renewable energy costs in Asia last year were 13% cheaper than coal and are expected to be 32% cheaper by 2030. China leads the pack with 40 to 70% cost reduction in utility-scale solar, onshore wind, and offshore wind compared to other Asian Pacific markets. The significant drop in solar power costs signals the end of supply chain disruptions and inflationary pressures. As a result, utility solar is now the cheapest power source in 11 out of 15 Asian countries. And some final good news as found on the site cooldown.com. Business Wire published a press release from Quaise Energy detailing the $40 million the company has secured to help implement the aggressive geothermal project, which is a result of research completed at MIT. If realized, the vision could quickly transform our energy system with cleaner, virtually unlimited geothermal power available all over the globe.
This was the Gaiagram, environmental headlines from around a planet in crisis.
WPKN programming is supported by Novamont, a Connecticut company, manufacturers of Matterbee, a family of completely biodegradable and compostable bioplastics, which are being used to provide low environmental impact solutions for everyday products. More information is available at materbi.com/en.
Hi, I'm Lydia Lovelace, and you're